call to order our February 15th meeting of the Ventura Park District Board of Commissioners. Let's start the open session with the Pledge of Allegiance. Todd, you lead us in the pledge, please?
Sure. Hand over heart, ready to begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, and liberty,
with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Todd. Let's move on to a roll call.
Commissioner Stevens.
Here.
Commissioner Brennan.
Present.
Commissioner Rainey's.
Here.
Vice Chair Cardina.
Here.
Andrew. Here. All right, we'll move on to adoption of the agenda, commissioners.
Yes, if I could, adoption of agenda.
Oh, I need to close that.
If you could
follow the script, Andy.
Yeah, there you go. I'd like to ask that we remove item B of the consent calendar and move it to the regular agenda. I'd like to ask a few questions, make a few comments on our Public Record Act policies.
Okay. All right, so Brian, we'll move that to the standard agenda. You want to just tack that to the end, or you want to move it anywhere else?
What do you think?
We get to go first on the standard agenda.
Okay.
That'll work.
All right.
I'll move the adoption of the agenda with that item being pulled.
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second to adopt the agendas, but moving consent item B to the standard agenda. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Hearing no one opposed, the amended agenda is adopted. All right, move on to approval of the minutes from our February 1st, 2023 meeting. Commissioners?
I'd move approval.
Second.
I have a motion and a second to approve the minutes from February 1st. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the minutes from February 1st are approved. All right. Now, Andy, we're ready for those public communications. So, Jessica, do we have anybody in the public wishing to make a comment on items that are not on tonight's agenda?
I do not have anybody on Zoom.
All right. Anybody in the audience wishing to welcome Councilman McReynolds?
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much. I just wanted to introduce myself, Bill McReynolds. Mayor Schroeder recently appointed me as the liaison to the Port District, so wanted to make sure this is the first chance I've had an opportunity to get out here for one of your meetings. I was at the new Council Member Academy your previous meeting, and then before that, I'm not quite sure. Getting long, but again, I just wanted to come out, introduce myself. I'm going to try to make these as often as I can. It's exciting. I'm on the east end of Ventura, so I don't get out to the water here as often. So it's nice to be out here. So again, I just wanted to introduce myself. Thank you for having me. I'm going to provide my cards, so just so you all have those. And if you have any questions, you know, my email, phone number, cell phone is right here. So I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Councilman. Congratulations on your election. Congratulations on the best appointment in the city. And we look forward to hosting you tomorrow to give you a more thorough tour of the Port District.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So I will close public communications and we'll move on to a closed session report. Councilor?
Thank you. I'm not elected to the council yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A closed session was held as set forth in the closed session agenda. The board had a report on one item. Board gave direction to staff as to how it might proceed. No action was taken that is reportable under the Brown Act.
Thank you, Andy. All right, we'll move on to board communications. Commissioners? Board communications, brief reports on issues related to the Port Commission. Anybody have anything to share tonight? Brian?
I just want to comment. I think, John, it was the video I think you sent around of the harbor mouth, I think, was it? I saw Todd. Yeah, thank you. That was a tough day. I was down on the beach. It was 15-foot faces. So looking at what was going on at the breakwater and at the mouth of the harbor, I mean, we effectively were a closed harbor. Thank goodness. I wouldn't want to see anybody going out there again, getting into trouble. Harbor Patrol have to go out to help them. So I know you're on duty and watching it, but I can certainly understand what watching that push down the channel. Can only understand how it got to the back of the harbor. And I think a rolling weir or some type of something that's a rare phenomenon that happens. But leave it to our harbor to have it happen. So I want to say thanks again, and certainly for all the quick support afterward. I know it's been almost a month now, but the ramifications of that are still very obvious. So thank you for, again, pass on to staff. Appreciate the quick response. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Looks like we have no other commissioner communications nor the board communications, so we'll close that and move on to our staff and general manager reports.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have all the departmental reports in the packet this evening. So if there's any questions, and we've got, looks like most of our managers from the departments out there tonight. So if you do have questions on the reports, a lot of great information in there for the public and for you as well. So we have that. I do also want to congratulate Councilmember McReynolds, who I think I've known for about 15 years or so, maybe longer than that at this point. So great to have him named as our liaison to the Port District. That's great. Look forward to working with him moving forward. Also had a chance to attend last week the Ventura County Special Districts Association annual meeting, which is in February each year. That was actually down at Channel Islands Harbor at the Yacht Club, and well attended. I think over 50 representatives from out the county, rec and park districts, ports and harbors, water districts, and so on. So a great turnout for that. I was reelected to serve on the board for another 2 years. I think I ran unopposed, we'll continue to provide that service for us for the county membership. And then also tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. at On the Alley, one of the things that we talked about was having some green initiatives come forward. The Ocean Friendly Restaurant Program. Jennifer, with our marketing team, helped to arrange that, and we've got some information out. Jessica's helped us with that as well. So that's at 9:30. It's going to be a guest speaker from the Ocean Friendly Restaurants co-chair with the Surfrider Foundation is going to be there. I think we have half a dozen restaurants or so that have signed up, and another reminder went out this afternoon. So looking forward to that. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's my report.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Commissioners, any comments, questions on the?
I just wanted to, I noticed that the dredging, we received at least a first look, and we were supposed to have scheduled for February, a prejudged survey is scheduled for February 8th, since we're past that point. What did that survey show?
So the pre-dredge survey came back with significantly more material, particularly in the sound trap, than anticipated. There was a pre-dredge survey done at the time when we contemplated sharing our carbon credits with Channel Islands Harbor. It was about 280,000 total yards. The survey came back at 625,000. Movable material is probably closer to 520,000 cubic yards, because the corners or the side slopes are difficult to move the material out of. But it is a significant difference than what anyone had contemplated prior to that.
And the base contract is for 350,000. So we've already made efforts to amend that.
Yeah, we had a meeting today with the Army Corps of Engineers to discuss our strong desire to have additional material moved, and they are considering that request. Yeah.
When do we expect the dredge to relocate up here?
So they are looking for, I think it's the last, about the 25th, 26th or so of February, roughly. They should be wrapping up down at Channel Islands Harbor and then moving up here next. So I think they're shooting for roughly a March 1st or so start here.
Give you something to talk about at CMANC. So. I wanted to make one comment on to our director of facilities, Sergio. The mailbox item was probably a small job, but I think it illustrates why we have shops. And you had a mailbox fall over in the storm, and you know that kind of stuff kind of makes the place look a little shabby when your mailbox is lying on the ground. And so it's great that we have the shops to be able to step in, get that thing back upright, and put some new concrete on it. So I just think that's a great testimony of why we have you and your team. So good work. All right, we will close the general manager report and move on to our consent agenda. We've reduced the consent agenda from two items to one. Again, the consent agenda is items typically non-controversial, voted on in one fell swoop. What's left on the agenda is out-of-town travel requests. We have five of those, three Harbor Patrol officers going to training, our Harbor Master and Sergio going to the JPI Leadership Academy. So we'll take a vote on the consent agenda. All in favor, say
There's
aye.
There's no public speakers. I'll go ahead and move the item.
Thank you. Do we have any public speakers? And anybody here want to make a comment on the consent agenda?
I don't comment the consent agenda. I have a comment about the dredging in the appropriate time, as I'd like to discuss it.
Okay, we'll finish with the consent agenda and then we'll figure out how to come back to that.
Public comment.
Yeah, there are at least two other items that dredging is a part of the 5-year objectives and then also the disaster declaration. So if you want to open it up at that time, that could be appropriate as well.
That sounds like a good suggestion. So, all right. So going back to the consent agenda, I got a motion on the table.
I'll second that.
And a second. So all in favor of approving the consent agenda as modified or taking item B away or deferring item B to the standard agenda, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Hearing none, the consent agenda as modified is approved. All right, we'll move on to the standard agenda. We're going to start off with the item that was removed from the consent agenda, and that's resolution 3468. Looking at policies and procedures for the Public Records Act. Brian, can I turn that over to you?
I don't know if we need a presentation.
Yeah, I think I'll ask if the commissioner has some questions or comments or all of the above, but we're all here and can help answer any questions.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Brian. And thank you, Mike and the commissioners for moving this onto the regular agenda. I have just a couple comments and based on my experience working with Public Record Act request over a number of years, and throw them out there and see if you agree. Maybe we can make some tweaks. First is in section 3. This would be an item B4. It's on page 64 of and it's the second attachment. The language there is like a double negative. These may seem like minor comments, but I think it's real important when we talk about Public Record Act requests, it'd be very clear to the public, right? To the people that are going to rely upon the document. And that language, the district may never make records available only in electronic form. I would just suggest, and this is somewhat in keeping Brian kind of you referenced green initiatives. Something that's missing in this, and I think we should, our first response should be to provide them in electronic form. I think we shouldn't be providing paper copies. I think my experience, most people don't want paper copies. They prefer to be given to them electronically. And I just think that that's a good policy for us to do. And of course, as this references in that section of the law, we can't only provide it electronically, but I think that should be our first take on it. So I would suggest that that sentence, which it, as I said, is something of a double negative, be replaced with something like the district shall make records available in electronic form or in hard copy upon request. Because I do think that should be our first way to go. And yeah, as I said, that's typically the way it works. Also, another minor point, this item really is in a section that's guidelines for the requester. These are really guidelines for staff. And I think it should be moved up into section A above that. Again, these are relatively minor. I just think it's going to flow better for the members of the public that are reading it. And then along those lines, in the form that we have people filling out, there's not a check. We have a checkbox for review it in person and a checkbox for putting it in the mail, as in with postage. So I think we need to have something in there that references email so they can check that box, get it to me via email. And then the last thing is in our recovery of costs. I know when I was at the county, what we found was that it cost us more to bill somebody $1.25 for their printing, right, than the $1.25 for printing. And so we set a floor. And I might suggest that we do something similar, and that any, for someone who did request it, copy, an actual hard copy, that anything below, I'll just throw a number out, $10, we don't bill for, because we're going to end up spending more money handling that money and the cost. So I would suggest we do something like that. So those are my comments. I'd like to hear from the other commissioners.
Appreciate the reframe. That I'm not sure about moving it that B4 up to A, only because for me as a requester, it's important for me to know that I need to make an explicit request for printed documents. So we may want to put something up above so that the but I do think as a requester, I need to know that I need to make an explicit request.
That's fine.
Brian or Tony, any other thoughts?
No.
Brian, if I think the changes that Chris suggests, you probably could make those changes. Do you see a need to bring this back to the board, or if we just?
No, I think it sounds like what I'm hearing is consensus for the changes. They're relatively minor. Mm-hmm. They're intended to obviously help the public and help staff from a cost perspective and so on. They're simple. I think you can modify the motion to include the changes that Commissioner Stevens has recommended, or he may want to make a motion or something along those lines. And then we'll just make those changes and put them in.
Then I will make a motion that we adopt this with the changes as I outlined and as modified by Jackie.
Can I, before I get a second on that, can I ask if there's any public comments on this? No public comments, and any public comments in the room? Okay, no public comments in the room. So we have a motion on the table.
Second.
And a second. So let me just, Chris, see if I capture this. So the motion is to approve the new policy, but we're going to reword section 3B4. I think we wanted to add some guidance to staff in section A. And then to the form that the public would use to request information, we would add an email option and then state that our policy is any costs that are less than $10 is the nominal number we're throwing out here tonight, but I think we give you the latitude to adjust that a little bit.
I think that's fine.
Any cost below $10, we don't recover. All right, so those are the changes as outlined. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. It's a roll call vote because it's a resolution. Thank you.
Commissioner Stevens?
Yes.
Commissioner Brennan?
Yes.
Commissioner Rainey?
Yes.
Vice Chair Gardena?
Yes.
Chair.
Yes. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for keeping us.
Thank you for humoring me.
Chris, that's why you're here. We leverage off of those years of experience with the county, right? Appreciate you adding that. All right, we're going to move on to our what was the first item in the standard agenda, which is a Brown Act presentation, an update on the Brown Act.
I'll start and turn over. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brian, just one quick second. Just want to make an our new council member. I know I listened into this council meeting on Monday, and they had a Brown Act presentation also. So if you leave in between, we'll understand why you've already done that. So anyway, just wanted to get that clear. Haven't been in that spot before. So
it looks like our timing is in good alignment with the city's presentation. Yeah, great. That's
Sorry
that's great. No, that's perfectly fine. Thanks.
Oh, there you go.
There we go.
Second opinions.
those are helpful. So tonight, General Counsel Andy Turner is going to be providing a presentation. I think one thing that might be helpful is to know if the board would like to do this on an annual basis. We sort of said it's been kind of periodic. You know, it is always good to get this reminder. I don't know if it needs to be annual or not, but certainly open to that if the board would like to do so. Certainly helpful. We have a new commissioner on as well, but certainly with your background, a lot of this is probably going to be repetitive in nature, but beneficial for not only the commission, but the staff, and of course the public as well. So
I would concur with that and basically say, I know working for a city, the auditors, especially the state auditor, always asks us if we've briefed the council and about the Brown Act. So I would encourage it every year.
Yeah, thank you. With that, Andy, I'll turn it over to you.
Reed Miller here is going to help me. I'll start us off, though. I gave him all the hard work. So, next slide. The Brown Act has a very simple principle, stated up there, that the people in delegating authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. So that's a rather pithy clause there, but it means that, you know, you are servants of the public. Public confidence is thinking beyond minimum legal standards. The Brown Act essentially sets a floor for conduct. It doesn't mean that you hew to the floor all the time, because just because it is legal doesn't mean it is ethical or that the public will perceive it to be so. Next slide, please. We're going to go through the application of the Brown Act. We're going to talk about legislative bodies. What is a legislative body? Reed will take us through the meetings. And then we'll handle some exceptions to the Brown Act. So again, California's open meeting laws provide legal minimums for local government transparency in decision-making. It's a public official's guide to the public's right of access in governmental affairs. Next slide, please. So we start with, what is a legislative body? Obviously, the governing board is a legislative body. Advisory committees created by the governing body are most often Brown Act committees and must comply with the Brown Act. Also, that includes private organizations when the organization is either created by the legislative body in order to exercise authority that may lawfully be delegated by the elected governing body to a private corporation or this body. You're not elected. An example of this would be, the obvious example Jessica and I have been talking about is the Public Facilities Corporation. That's a private corporation, but the board is the same board as the Board of Commissioners. And when that was created umpteen years ago, we treated it as a Brown Act body. So who is subject to the act? All local legislative governing bodies or agencies. any board that governs a private entity, any board, commission, or committee which is created by a local governing body, including permanent, temporary, advisory, or decision-making committees. An example of that is very often, most often I see it in rate making. Oftentimes, you know, when a public body is going to increase rates of some sort, they might create a citizens advisory council to, you know, to talk about it. You might have a board member or two on that council, and that would be a Brown Act meeting. Temporary committees can either be, you have standing committees and temporary committees, which are often called ad hoc committees. Standing committees, and you don't have used committees here, but, you know, the city has several committees. A water district, for example, will have an engineering committee and a personnel committee, things like that. And those are what we call standing committees because they have continuing subject matter jurisdiction. They are essentially assigned the task of meeting regularly to review engineering matters or personnel matters and things like that. And then they report back to the larger body. And it's just a way of making the government move a little more efficiently. Those are standing committees, and they are what we call Brown Act committees. They would have to comply with the Brown Act, even though you only have two members on that committee. It's not a quorum of your board. Temporary ad hoc committees comprise less than a quorum of the board, are not subject to the Brown Act. Temporary does not mean limited by a time frame, or instead it means limited to a specific task. I've seen boards have an ad hoc committee for when you're doing a general manager search or something like that, have an ad hoc committee to come up with a short list of names. So you take that laborious job out of the board's purview and it moves along quicker. So temporary committees are not Brown Act committees. And let me stop there. Questions? Feel free to interrupt me anytime with questions. I should have said that at the beginning. All right, now I'm going to turn it over to Reed to do the yeoman's work.
All right. Thank you. Nice to see everybody. I'm going to start by seeing if you're paying attention to Andy, get people involved and engaged. Which of these three groups are not subject to the Brown Act? Number one, a standing committee. Number two, a board of directors. Or number three, a temporary committee. You guys are good. You listened. And why is that? I'll tell you, because it's on the last slide. Less than a quorum. Limited single purpose. Again, some of the examples Andy gave. Not perpetual, and it's usually dissolved after that task or objective is achieved. Next slide, please. All right, in the next few slides, there's going to be a little crossover because we're talking about meetings, and we're going to figure out what, other than an actual meeting, the definition can constitute a meeting. So obviously, we know that an in-person gathering is a meeting. We're all here together. The actual definition of under the Brown Act is any gathering of a majority of the members at the same time, place to hear and discuss or deliberate on an issue under the jurisdiction of the group that's together. And the reason and the importance and significance that you'll see, you'll hear a lot tonight, and it's part of the Brown Act, is that because you're a public body, and as we've heard tonight, you know, there's taxpayers and a lot of, you know, you have fiduciary obligations, et cetera. If you're going to deliberate on government business, the meeting, the whatever you want to call it, again, could be a meeting, it could be a chain of emails, et cetera. If it triggers the definition of a meeting, it needs to be open. You need to provide an opportunity for the public to comment, and you have to have notice and follow all the protocols for posting agendas, et cetera. And we'll get into those exceptions. What are some things that can be disguised as meetings? As you can see, especially in the last 10 years where everybody's always on their phone and there's so many different social media applications, that opens up a whole new, you know, door to what could constitute, you know, that fine line of communicating with a friend, posting an emoji, et cetera, to when you're actually sharing information and maybe gathering opinions or even just, you know, trying to see what people might think about a upcoming something that should actually be noticed on the agenda, et cetera. So a serial meeting is specifically prohibitive. And how do you achieve that? And what are you supposed to not do to stay away from that territory? Number one, email, we know, and I know there's a slide coming up about email, but in this day and age, everything is over email. What should you not do generally? Usually, I would refrain from replying all, just because number one, you have a written record. We talked a little bit about the Public Records Act. All that is subject to being requested by the public. But again, it leads to the main thing here is that you want to stay away from that, those communications being forwarded on, and enough people start commenting that an opinion or dialogue, excuse me, is formed, which then triggers the definition of the meeting, and you'd be in violation because that meeting would not be noticed with opportunity for the public to weigh in on certain agenda items, et cetera. What are not meetings? Well, there are some exceptions. Number one, individual contacts. Obviously, anybody here on the board, we're talking about news media, et cetera. You can talk to a reporter. You can talk to friends. You can talk to professional advisors, et cetera. You can attend conferences and seminars as long as, again, they're open to the public and it's a topic of general interest. Those are the two things. Community meetings such as town meetings, town hall, et cetera. The key here is open and noticed. Purely social event. The ad hoc committees we talked about and we had the quiz about. And then a meeting with other legislative bodies. So, for example, if there was something where you were working with another, the city council or something, this group could go and attend that group. But again, with all of these, you still are restrained where you cannot get together as a group or a few of you, especially over a quorum, and talk about official business. But you can attend, you can sit together. Those things are fine. With that, I have another quiz for you. This one's a little complicated. A violation of the Brown Act? Here we go. A majority of the board, our governing body, we'll say the board here, attends a homeowners association meeting. It's limited only to the residents of that particular development, and it's only publicized to the members of that housing association. Is that a
part of their community?
Yes, they are.
Three members live in that same
community. Right, correct. It's to discuss the development itself.
Well, I personally would say no. They're exercising their individual right as a citizen because they live in that area and they're anxious.
Correct. That said, this came from a case where, depending on what kind of conversations that specific group would have at that meeting, outside of talking specifically about the housing related issues, because that meeting was limited to only residents, so it's not open to anybody in the public. And it's only publicized or noticed to those members. So again, it's a fine line. And that's why I thought that would be a good example. She's always got to be careful again. And if you're at an event where it could already be on the border, you want to just make sure you're staying away from anything even remotely related to your role in this official capacity.
If you gave an ex parte communication at your next council meeting, would that moderate you in some way? Would that be part of the...
You mean if you, after this event, were at a...
Yeah, then you go to your elected body and you have an ex parte communication, or at least detailing what happened at that meeting.
If it pertains strictly to the housing-related issues, yeah, you're fine. But that is a good thing that you bring up because it has to do with anything. For example, if a few of you left tonight and went outside and you spoke about something that came out of this meeting, that would be, you could not do that. But if you all went outside and spoke about the housing, the HOA meeting you went to last night about, and you were upset about some assessment or something, that would be okay. But again, it's you just got to be very tread lightly.
You
know? Correct. Yeah. And that's what a lot of this is. you know, it's basically you're here to serve the public interest and you want to look honest and ethical and open. If anything, you err on the side of looking more open and transparent. That's perfect. Next slide. I will go into that right now. So this is a relatively new bill. It's the first one that was adopted as an amendment to the Brown Act to address this issue because social media has become so prevalent in the last, you know, 5-10 years. I can't even keep track of all the new apps on your phone that I don't have, and I'm behind the times. I'm aging myself. But what this allows is board members are allowed to communicate and use social media to provide information to the public, especially if they have a following or they're trying to get a message out, gather public support for something. However, it becomes a little bit of risky when you're connected or friends with, especially in a social network like Facebook or something, and you could be friends with one another and you post a comment. It could be an opinion that borders on the line of, you know, something that is within your jurisdiction, and then another board member comments, even as it says something as much as a wink, a smiley face or a frowny face, because even that can communicate, I support this item. I do not. I don't feel as strongly about it. So that's one thing to remember. And then this also has to do with email, which is my next slide. If we could go to the next slide.
I'd like to hold up on the social media one. Our marketing group does a great job of having a presence on social media. I'm known in the family as being somewhat of an Instagram junkie, and one of my favorite things is seeing what the Ventura Port District is up to. So you're telling me that if they post a great thing about what's happening this upcoming holiday weekend, and I say I'm looking forward to whatever the events are, and another commissioner chimes into that, we could be getting ourselves into trouble?
I would not. If you keep it very much like, yes, looking just, forward to the weekend, looking
pretty innocuous.
But again, with all these things, you couldn't say I'm looking forward to the weekend except this thing I'm disappointed about that came out of last night's meeting that you just thought of in the same train of that comment, or even if it's just, you know, people fire off things and then they regret it. Because everything's fast at the tip of your fingertips. So technically, I would advise against, especially if you see other members liking is one thing, but comments is where you start to get into potential trouble. It could be completely fine and honest and ethical, but it's again the public perception, and then it's just one thing for somebody to potentially point at and say, I read this way, and you might have meant it that way, but. Again, it starts that conversation.
So on LinkedIn, there's a post about the squid harvesting. And there's a report.
If you're on LinkedIn and there's a comment about squid harvesting and more than one commissioner is on there and they start not a dialogue, but commenting back and forth, could that be interpreted as being a meeting?
If you have less than a majority, you're usually going to be okay. So if it's two or three of you, but the point is when you put something out on the internet like that, and it could be 3 months later and it's condensed because it's a long chain and somebody that tips it over a majority starts commenting, technically, that could be a violation, even though in context, it probably is not. They didn't notice. Maybe it had already been deleted. So it's just that's something to consider. And again, a lot of the stuff is a fine line. So it's just exercising good judgment. But the examples you brought up today, whether it's talking about the squid catch or weather, et cetera, you're usually going to be fine because most people across the board are not going to. That's very neutral. And obviously, it's really hard to take that and extract it and say that's part of, you know, your official business or an item that should be saved for a notice meeting. So, again, it's just exercising sound judgment. But
with like AB 992 here, it's relatively new, so we don't have a lot of court decisions. is really what we like, what we, you know, lawyers rely on. We go back to a court decision where maybe the issue at hand was close to your issue, and that helps provide guidance. Oftentimes the courts will help provide guidance. We haven't gotten that yet, because this one is, to me, a little confusing. Not a lot, you know, as typical when the legislature gets together, they don't provide, they're not a model of clarity. And I just think, as Reed said, I just think when you see other board members on the same chain or whatever, you bow out.
Yeah. My experience has been, don't do it. Don't ever respond to another member's comment, period. It's a simple, it's a good way to avoid any problem.
Correct.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, question back for the attorneys, but I mean, usually the type of thing I see is just, you know, great opportunity. I attended this event over the weekend. Done. I mean, you know, great opportunity. I think we should be spending more money on that activity. And what do you all think? I think we just hit your issue.
Right. Yes, of course. And the thing is, obviously, you're more aware of this than some people, but a lot of people, the general public, will use social media to vent or argue or start that conversation. And you are not in the position to roll the dice on that. And it's not the way that you would want to have that conversation. You want to have it here. So yes, again, it is new. I haven't seen that much on it. We'll know more in the next few years. A lot of it probably seems a little kind of over, you know, a little bit ridiculous even, because again, as your example pointed out, you could just be saying, wonderful weekend, I can't wait to get in, you know, put the boat out or whatever it is. But unfortunately, this is coming from the statute. And again, it could be interpreted many ways. So err on the side of being safe and not, you know, making anything, you know, any comments that could be even mildly potentially perceived as, you know, communicating an opinion. Okay. Any other questions? Sorry. Okay. Next slide. Email. Okay. So as I mentioned already, email can be very dangerous. It's a permanent public record, and kind of like social media, as I mentioned, the minute you fire it off or forward it to something, you could not know that somebody's on the chain that maybe you did not intend to be on the chain. It might be somebody that replies all every time, and all of a sudden they've replied all with something that could be perceived as an opinion, or even trying to you know, garner interest in something. Are you, what do you feel about this? How do you think this person will weigh in on that? Just something simple like that, and you have one other person on that thread, you might be in danger of violating the act. And this comes into kind of what I was just talking about. Under the Brown Act, email communication is considered a technological device within the meaning of meetings. So it becomes, it can be the same thing as another human being in the game of telephone, which you're all aware of, where you tell somebody next to you something, that spreads. Same thing can be done with email or social media. You're just typing it instead of saying whatever it is to the person next to you, and it keeps getting forwarded, misinterpreted, misconstrued, replied to with, you know, different types of comments that you probably didn't think it would garner, et cetera. So it's, and again, with all of this, the term, what we're trying to get away from is anything that can be perceived as influencing or developing a collective concurrence on any action that's going to be taken on an upcoming agenda item. So again, polling, having even a staff member email a couple people, it could be about a meeting or something, but if there's anything that would trigger a response where they would say, I'm kind of thinking about this, or what, this is what I'm concerned about, anything like that, you're running the risk of being on the border of triggering a violation of the Brown Act. So again, just be conscious. Sure, again, you guys are, but we're just reminding you, because some of these can be, again, very much delicate and on the line. Any questions about email? Okay, next slide. Okay, as you know, there's different kinds of meetings. Right now, we're here at the regular meeting. With that, as I've heard tonight, and I'm sure you're well aware of, there are a lot of requirements when it comes to posting agendas. They have to be posted 72 hours ahead of time. I'll get into something a little later that talks about an exception to that that just changed under a new bill that came out last year. Special meetings, anything, a meeting that's attended by a majority at any time. With that, the key is the agenda has to be posted at least 24 hours ahead of the meeting. And that agenda should be usually limited to the specific discussion point or topic that's going to be discussed there and that's warranted by the special meeting. With adjourned meetings, that, you know, that can work for a regular or special meeting. If they're adjourned, you don't need to re-notice them or re-agenda, send out the agenda again. All you need to do is say, post on the website that it's been adjourned. And as long as it's reconvened in 5 days, you're fine and there's no issue. Emergency meetings, they may be called without notice if the public health or safety may be impaired, very rarely used. If there's an emergency situation, it would require a majority vote of the board. And again, these are not things that were that are very common. Some of them have popped up during COVID, and it's usually not an emergency situation, but it's something I'll go into in a moment that have to do with postponing or having different ways of attending meetings.
Quick question on the adjourned meeting. We haven't seen that here. I don't, certainly not in the time I've been here, but an adjourned meeting could be we get into a meaty discussion and it's 11 o'clock at night and everybody's just too tired to think clearly. We could adjourn the meeting and then reconvene.
Yes.
And that's what you call an adjourned meeting.
Correct.
Reconvene within that 5 days.
The 5 day period.
Yeah. Okay.
You have to adjourn to a specific time and place.
Oh, you declare that.
So you can't just simply say, we'll figure out the time later. You'd say, we have to adjourn to next Thursday at 5 o'clock at this location.
And okay.
Subsequently post notice adjourned.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, meeting agenda items that ties into this is the second slide. The first was an introduction. So as you know, for normal regular meetings, the agenda has to be posted 72 hours in advance. You have to have the time, location, a brief description of each action item to be discussed and addressed, and any closed door items. The notices have to be available in alternative ADA formats and distributed in advance to anybody who requests copies. As far as public participation is concerned, which is a key consideration when it comes to the Brown Act, is that no action or discussion can be allowed for any item that is not listed on the agenda, except for a few exceptions. Those are a brief response or statement to a question from the public, a staff reference, information or question of clarification or instruction. Again, kind of usually has to do with public participation. A brief announcement on a member's own staff activities, and then adding items by a majority vote for an emergency situation or by a two-thirds vote if there's an item that needs immediate action, which again, those don't come up often, but those are the exceptions to, again, following the normal agenda rules. A special meeting, as I mentioned, has to be posted no later than 24 hours in advance. And the public's rights to comment. So this is something that I thought was of interest or something that I've kind of skipped over in the past is that for any regular agenda item, the public can comment at any time on those items. The board can listen. They usually are still constrained by what is on the agenda, but they still have to allow the public participation up to an extent. There could be time limits. It can be reasonable, et cetera. However, when it comes to special and emergency meetings, they can address a body on any item on the agenda, because again, those are usually pretty narrow, warning the special meeting to be called. Every meeting needs to provide the opportunity for the public to get up and speak, and that can be anything from providing testimony, criticizing the agency, requesting copies of documents or anything that's been discussed in the meeting. And again, subject to some reasonable limitations, that has to be allowed.
Two quick questions on that. So you said public communications can be on items not on the agenda, but you said there can be a brief response to those items. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. even if it's not on the agenda, the public could come up with a question. We could, if it was a straightforward answer, we could answer that question, and that's yes. Okay. All right. The second question I have is on this issue of two-thirds. We have five members on the board. Do you round up or do you round down?
It'd be four-fifths.
Okay. So it'd have to round up. Okay.
And on the purse matter you rose, I think we had some examples of that when there was trash in the harbor and somebody made public comment and some board members responded to that. As long as we don't get into a substantive discussion of a matter within your jurisdiction, you're going to have limited responses to members of the public.
And that's why we have counsel here to tell us when we're getting close to that line.
That's right.
All right. With that, I will turn it back over to Andy for a moment, and then I'll be back.
Thanks, Reed. We're going to talk about closed session. It must be expressly authorized by an explicit statutory provision. We generally have in the Brown Act, they have what we call the safe harbor descriptions, and we invariably use those. It's set forth in the Brown Act. We use that description, so we know we've given an adequate description of what the item is for the closed session agenda. Must be verbally announced before we go into closed session. Any action or no action must be reported. We usually report no action taken. Common closed sessions include personnel, labor, real property negotiations, and litigation. Closed sessions are confidential. Disclosure is prohibited. You're guilty of a misdemeanor if you disclose what goes on in closed session, but I got to tell you, I'm not sure I've ever seen that happen. An example would be way back a few years back, the city council wanted to close session to discuss the closure of LA's King Drew Medical Trauma Center. The Board of Supervisors met in closed session and decided to close the hospital. The DA concluded that the board intentionally violated the Brown Act by making that decision in closed session because it was an inadequate description on the item. But then there were no charges due to lack of evidence. That's what I was saying earlier. I've really never seen charges. We call that is the DA can give you a slap on the wrist. I've seen matters referred to what's called the Public Integrity Division of the LA County. I'm sure they have the same here in Ventura County. Most counties have a Public Integrity Division, and they handle things like complaints regarding violations of the Brown Act. And it's a pretty bright line. I had a small district up in Lancaster, out west Lancaster, and they had maybe 250, 300 water connections, and the board met at this clubhouse at this little private lake that the original developer built. And one of the board members was a contractor. And so they're remodeling the office, and he volunteered to help remodel the office on his dime. But maybe the board would give him his per diem of something like $80. Some elected officials get a per diem. Well, somebody caught wind of that. They complained. I remember I went to a meeting with Steve Cooley. This was before he was the DA, up because he was out of the Lancaster office. And he basically said to the guy, look, it's a violation of the Brown Act. You was in the conflict of interest stuff. You took money for doing something for the district that the board didn't direct you to, you didn't contract for it. And if you pay back I think he worked 3 days at $80 a day. If you pay back the $240, we'll call it a day. So various violations of the public integrity stuff, the DA gives you essentially a light sentence and slap on the wrist. Yes.
Yeah, just a quick question, because on here it says any action or no action must be reported. And since I've been here, you say there's no action reportable under the Brown Act when you report out. And so I just want to be clear, for myself and the public, what is deemed to be an action in closed session?
An action would be where, for example, the board has an anticipated litigation, or they can go into closed session to decide whether to file a lawsuit. And it's a matter that's not been delegated to staff by the board, and they decide they're going to file a lawsuit, and they do that in the closed session, then that would be an action that was taken.
So when the board does an action, it is something that was voted on in the closed session?
Yes.
So it's specifically a vote that occurs in the closed session?
Correct. And the vote has to be reported out.
Versus a direction or guidance that's been provided. Okay, thank you.
Usually the direction is that, you know, it's delegated to the general manager to handle because he's your business operator. Next slide, please. This is AB 2647. I believe this is last year. It's last year, the year before, last year, right? Revises the Brown Act of the public disclosure. Now, normally you have to have your agenda items, and all your matters in public session are in the agenda packet that goes out. This new law would allow you to send out additional materials to board members after the agenda was posted, so long as you make physical copies available for public inspection at the beginning of the next business day. And you post it on your website if you have a website. So it does allow the board to take into consideration a different additional materials for an action that's already on the posted agenda. You're not really adding an agenda item. You're just supplementing the information for your board members. And as long as that posted on the website, you must have an initial staff report containing executive summary relating to that agenda item. We usually do that with every agenda item. We have a staff report. The agency lists the web address of the agency's internet website on the agendas for all meetings of the legislative body of that agency, and makes physical copies available at the meeting. So it's what I view as a kind of a minor thing from the Brown Act's perspective, but it does, I think, oftentimes when they mess with the Brown Act, they're not providing greater flexibility, but this one is rare in that it does provide a little greater flexibility for distribution of materials for consideration. I'll turn it back to Reed.
All right, thank you. Okay, so this was actually talked about earlier today because I think, Michael, you mentioned that you saw this in the agenda. So, yes, this is a new law that came out the first of this year. It relaxes some of the requirements, the current requirements for remote participation by a board member. And those are, again, as you know from that same conversation, they're a little bit restrictive in that if somebody is traveling or not present, you have to post the agenda item there. You have to post the location, et cetera, which can be awkward, a violation of privacy, just doesn't quite make sense. So obviously there are exceptions here, and those are for emergency situations and just cause. And as the situation with Michael mentioned earlier, that is because he'll be traveling away on official business. So that falls under, if we can go to the next slide, I have those examples or what the definition is. So that's number four there, travel while on official business of the legislative body in another state or local agency. The others are, of course, caregiving, an illness, need related to a physical or mental disability that cannot be accommodated by somebody else. The key here is that these first set, the just cause, they can be used by a member up to two times per calendar year. And the key here also is that these do not require board approval, which is not the case for the second set, which I'll go into a moment. So again, any of these qualify. You can use them up to two times per year, and you don't need to request it in a meeting. Whereas the second set is emergency circumstances, and that is the definition there. It means a physical or family medical emergency that prevents somebody from attending in person. In this instance, unlike Just Cause, it actually requires the board member to request to participate remotely and provide a brief statement of why they are justified or need to do that during the meeting. The legislative body then has the opportunity to grant that, or they elect to not grant the request. And one other restriction here when it comes to, although this emergency circumstance can be used any number of times subject to the board approval, those guidelines, the key is, and I think we handed out a supplemental memo because there is a lot to this bill, because it also recodifies some of the procedures in AB 361, which is the bill that was put out during COVID that expires this month. So all those, the ability to do teleconferencing, those have not changed. It's just these two prongs provide an ability to more relaxed remote attendance. And in that, let's see.
I think one thing we left out of this slide is that don't you need you need a quorum of the board to be physically here in person. And that's in the memo.
Right. Yes. Sorry.
Supplemental memo. Because this is, again, a fairly confusing statute. It kind of, and the interesting thing is from the first slide, I don't know if you saw, it expires in what, 2026?
Yeah, 2026.
January 1, 2026. So we got to put up with this for 3 years. At that point, maybe they'll continue it. Oftentimes they do with those sunset provisions, but it's just like they're – COVID has made the legislature kind of test the waters in various areas to see if we can come up with a game plan for dealing with these issues moving forward. And I think this is an example of that.
Yes. And in that memo, it talks about the quorum. It's still the quorum has to be here in the physical location, still has to follow, have the agenda, have it noticed, have the location, et cetera. So, and again, that's a helpful guide to look at because it also, again, shows the current less relaxed options you still have for remote participation. Okay, next slide.
Just want to clarify your
question? Sure.
I want to go ahead. But
so travel, but not on official business. You couldn't. It's that doesn't qualify as just cause for remote
attendance. Right, like a vacation or something. No, correct. Yeah, you'd have to follow the more stringent requirements of, again, going back to posting the agenda and your location and making your hotel room open to the public in theory, et cetera. So
you have to be at the Super Bowl.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Well, or on official business for my company.
Correct.
That wouldn't qualify because right. It's not official business for this legislative body. Okay.
Another question. So you cannot create the quorum with the third member being remote. You said there has to be
a number of on your
provision board, right? That you mentioned. Yeah. Three would have to be here that already. So it's not helpful in terms of creating the quorum. It's just helpful in terms of that members can be remote and participate in the meeting.
Correct.
Okay.
Tony would actually be a good example because you work for a city, right? So he could be traveling on official business for that city and participate in the meeting remotely under that last just cause bullet.
Well, could he? Because it has to be of this legislative body.
No. Travel while on official business of the legislative
body. Or another state or local agency. Okay.
That's interesting. Your city could send you to the Super Bowl.
Like you're floating.
You can still go to the Super Bowl. You just have to post it.
Yes. Yeah. Remember?
Okay. All right. Next slide, please. All right. So this ties into what we were kind of talking about earlier with interacting with the public and potentially disruptive meeting attendees. This is a relatively new bill that also came out January 1st of this year. It was passed in relation to the California legislature recognizing some of the disruption in public gatherings and meetings that have taken place in the last 2 years due to protests for racism, LGBTQ rights, et cetera, and where you have big groups of people or one rambunctious individual coming in, causing a disruption, you know, waving a flag, doing something, anything to disrupt and take away from the meeting and what the official business that is there to take place. And it allows for the body to remove either break up a willful or if there's actually a group, a big protest group, you can all agree that this is disruptive. It's usually going to be pretty black or white if, you know, they're distracting everybody. The actual definition is disruptive behavior that actually disrupts, disturbs, impedes, or renders infeasible the orderly conduct of the meeting, including but not limited to behavior that violates one of the governing body's regulations addressing conduct of open meetings, or a reasonable observer would perceive as a threat to use of force by that member of the public. When it comes to that, also, normally, other than a threat, which I'll say one moment, it requires warning that the behavior is inappropriate, and if they continue, they're going to be removed. That said, if the behavior is threatening and it's physical violence, you do not need to give any sort of warning. You can take any measures to make sure that that individual is removed and that everybody can be safe and go on with the business you were there to conduct.
It's a good thing you have a harbor patrol.
Yes. And with that, the final slide, I will turn it back over to Andy.
I should have just left this slide with Reed.
The ramifications of a violation of the Brown Act. Violations can be prevented by court order. Somebody can go to court if you're repeatedly violating the Brown Act, and go to court and get a court order preventing you from doing whatever you're doing and get their attorney's fees and costs. Individual violations of the Brown Act may be guilty of a misdemeanor. If the action is taken and the member intended to deprive the public of information to which the member knows of or has reason to know, the public is entitled. So that's kind of a narrow definition of when you're going to be able to call it a misdemeanor. Disclosure of confidential, as I said earlier in a closed session, disclosure of confidential closed session information is prohibited. That similarly is a misdemeanor, but it's ill-defined. And as I said before, I don't think any of us at our office have ever seen a case where a misdemeanor has been charged. And with that, I'll open it for questions.
Commissioners, questions?
No questions. I just want to say I really appreciate the thoroughness of it, and especially with the new laws that have come into effect. So very helpful. Thanks. Well, and I really love the interactive quizzes that kept us on our toes.
This must be a professor at heart.
I've got one follow-up question. What would you say is the most common violation of the Brown Act? And I assume it's an inadvertent.
Yeah, it could be. My local government professor in law school was city attorney for the city of Avalon, and he flew out there in the helicopter for the evening council meetings, and he went out to dinner with the council. So the most common violation is going to be when they're sitting around having dinner together before the meeting, and what are we going to do with that third item there, you know, something like that, and that starts a little conversation. There you have a violation. I think that's the most common when you have a quorum of the board at the neighborhood cocktail party. And, you know, somebody comes along and asks you a question about district business, and you don't want to be impolite, and you try to give them a quick answer, and then maybe one of the other board members says, well, you know, and all of a sudden now you're having a discussion. I think those are going to be the most common pitfalls, is that having a gathering that turns into a meeting.
Mm-hmm. And I would say probably from my years being on council over the years, I think the perception of seeing four council members at a meeting People go, oh, is that a Brown Act violation? Well, maybe sitting in the same row, maybe sitting next to each other. But if you're at something at a presentation that is, we want to get the information, I'm sitting around, make sure there's some space and then just go in and out and not discuss it. But then, you know, I mean, it gets referred to the district attorney, and I've been interviewed, I think, a couple times, as council members have, because we're all in the same place at once, not right. sitting together, not talking together, but it's just the public. And that's a perception that sometimes I think you need to go above and beyond, because some of these things, well, more is being taped or recorded now, so you come back. I'd say 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. So I think the district attorney was getting all kinds of calls because, oh, there's four people in the same room. I just think that, I guess the perception of it, sometimes it was more than actually, and then the district attorney would say there was no violation or what much the case. But I know it's still the public, just seems it's four people or three people in this case in the same room, or going to a ribbon cutting down here, or going to the Parade of Lights, you know. And if you're on the, you know, I mean, again, trying to be as far apart as we can, I think, is probably the best way to go about it.
One of the more classic pitfalls is that, like, a CSDA conference, California Special District Association, or the AQUA conference. Yeah. Usually after a day of sessions, there may be a quorum that attended the conference, and they're sitting around having a beer or a cup of coffee or whatever, and they're sitting at a table chatting, and people see them, and everybody in the room knows about the Brown Act at these conferences, and look at that and go, what are they talking about?
Just my experience, and this falls under the category of inadvertent, it is noticing requirements and failing to meet those noticing requirements for meetings. Quite often they're caught and they realize they didn't get the notice out, then they just delay the item to the next meeting. But that's one that I've seen probably the most over the years. They just didn't get the meeting notice posted in time, or they didn't send it out to the proper individuals and things of that nature. I'd say that's probably the number one thing that we've dealt with. And then maybe secondarily will be and especially with the email coming along, the serial meetings, that kind of thing will come up. And I think many times inadvertently, but not always.
And if I could add something to your point, I was going to say that comes up a lot again, the notice issue. And one thing to note is that, you can't go straight to court. The DA can't just file a lawsuit or anything like that. Absent, straight with them, like, excuse me.
Usually you're going to receive notice of some sort of the issue with the agenda, non-agenda item, excuse me. But what they provide is a safe harbor to then go back and undo whatever was incorrect, accurate, and, you know, go through the formal process. So you always have that. You don't want to turn to it, but that's something to make note of. It's also how you handle the situation. And I just mentioned that because that's something that comes up that you can cure. You have the ability to cure, and it can be done relatively easy. And then you learn to make sure to follow the procedures going forward.
Yeah. And it's been a few occasions where my client has gotten such a notice, but every time I say, let's just re-notice it for the next meeting and do it over again. We've cured it. We haven't, and it gets away from this individuals wanting to file a lawsuit and doing all that. And then, of course, I have to talk my client off of, well, we did it right, you know. And I said, well, what's the point of, you know, path of least resistance here? Let's just, it doesn't have to happen immediately. It's not an urgent item. Let's just, 2 weeks from now, we can meet again and redo it right.
Okay, so as Commissioner Gradina said, good interaction, good discussion, much appreciated, very thorough. We've had a lot of dialogue, but just before we close this out, any other comments from the room, any public comments, online? This is not an item we need to take any kind of vote on. It was just educational, so I think we can close this item. Thank you very much, and we'll move on to our second item on the standard agenda, which is our update on 5-year objectives.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've got our PowerPoint slides here with our quarterly update. And if we could start right there on guiding principles. Just a reminder for everybody, this is in the PowerPoint attached to the the board report as well. The board adopted what had been previously long-term goals or goals and repurposed those into guiding principles and rewrote those and adopted those. And from that, updated the five-year objectives to provide guidance for projects moving forward. So the guiding principles are here. There are eight of them, everything from maintaining the safe and navigable harbor, advancing our vibrant working waterfront, growing financial sustainability, establishing and implementing harbor-wide environmental sustainability policies, building respectful, productive relationships with all of our stakeholders, providing exceptional public service and organizational transparency, providing high-quality harbor and coastal visitor-serving amenities, and supporting the Channel Islands National Park in its effort to provide a first-class visitor center and educational resources. So again, from that, next slide, please. The board adopted updates to the original five-year goals that it had implemented back in 2020, I think it was. And, you know, you see a bold over certain words in here, which sort of highlight what each of these are about. So, of course, I always point out that staff is busy managing the port on a day-to-day basis. And certainly these are not the only things that staff are working on, but they are certain projects and programs and activities that obviously have met this threshold of becoming specific five-year objectives. So in the first, we talk about dredging as it relates to the Harbor Entrance Channel, which is a federal entrance channel, and the Inner Harbor dredging. We talk about encouraging public and civic engagement, and the board adopted a public and civic engagement plan and just recently updated that again. We know that we are an important commercial fishing harbor and recreational fishing opportunity for the region as well, collaborating with our master tenants and the National Park Service in planning and improving the harbor in a financially and environmentally sustainable way. Working with the National Park Service presence and customer visitation here to the harbor, implementing parking management, traffic circulation, and multimodal transportation strategies, seeking opportunities to grow revenues and secure grants. You've certainly seen a lot of successful efforts in these areas to grow the revenue beyond what the district has in its own resources. And then maintain and improve Harbor Village facilities, infrastructure, and amenities. One of the things that the board did in adopting these a couple of years back and then updating to these new five-year objectives is having staff come back on a quarterly basis and for the benefit of the public and, of course, for you to see the status of these projects is provide a quarterly report that uses the SMART goal principles and the rest of the PowerPoint presentation does that for each of these eight areas. Next, please. So the first is dredging. And tonight I was going to do what we've done in some of our similar meetings where we've done updates on the quarterly objectives, which is highlight a couple, but either stop me or, you know, or I can keep going and then we can come back and talk about any of these in more detail. And again, we've got staff here as well who can help with that too. So just to hit a couple on a couple here as it relates to dredging. I should note, since we talked about this being sort of quarterly results, this is for the period ending through December 31st of 2022, that quarter, October through December. In many instances, you know, there has been continued movement, action, decisions that you've made in several of these, and that's a good thing. But it's not necessarily reflected in this since this goes back a little bit in time. So a couple of notes. The chair and Todd Mitchell and I attended the fall CMAQ meeting in South San Francisco back in October. Had a chance to get up to speed on a variety of important issues related to dredging and national and federal dredging topics. Also, in terms of working with our lobbyist, last fall, we began working to secure a visit from our new congressman, Salud Carbajal. That turned out to be a very timely effort in late fall, translating to a visit in January that initially was intended to discuss the ongoing federal dredging needs, but with the storm impacts, gave the opportunity for the new congressman to our district to have a chance to tour the harbor with Harbor Patrol, with John Higgins and chair and vice chair staff, and be able to take him and his staff around and see that. I think that's already netting results. I think we have correspondence coming from his office to the Army Corps to your question earlier, Vice Chair, about federal dredging and the quantities and so on in support of additional dredging. So my understanding is I believe the Corps will be receiving that letter this week. Next. So next is the encourage public and civic engagement and maintain high levels of organizational transparency and promote harbor-wide diversity, equity, and inclusion through district policies, procedures, and programs. A couple things to highlight here. Celebrating DEI through recognition of dates and events of cultural significance. One of the things that you've seen, Jennifer's here this evening, is that in the annual marketing plan, this has become part of the efforts in expanding these. So in the achievements, we've got ongoing content development and recognition to celebrate DEI, including this quarter, Hispanic Heritage Month, American Indian Heritage Month, Dia de los Muertos, and so on. So I think that's really something that we've very much expanded upon in the last couple of years, and maybe even more so in the last 12 months. So that's been great to see.
Just a quick question about that. Do we have any metrics to know whether or not those efforts are actually increasing access to and the diversity of our visitors?
I mean, one of the ways we track metrics is through, you know, vehicle counts that come in, you know, in terms of looking at those numbers. I mean, I really think, and Jennifer, I don't know if you want to add anything. I mean, this has sort of now become part of the ongoing outreach efforts. I don't know if you look at it, Jennifer, from the perspective of how many followers you have, for example, on Instagram or other social media accounts. Have they continued to increase? Can you attribute any of the success of that to some of these efforts? So do you want to provide any comment on that quickly?
Good evening, Chairman and Commissioners. That's a great question, Commissioner Gardena. And I absolutely feel like this is kind of our first full year of going through this programming, and we are getting our hands around that. But not only for these particular things, I do want to point out that we're increasing DEI across all facets, so really showcasing more of who we want to see here, but also that's reflective of who is here. So we are taking a look at that and really fine tuning our photo and our video library for that. And then also our websites, we just did kind of a refresh of that recently too, and just really tried to be reflective of who we see visiting the harbor right now. But that's a great question, and we'll work on that, and I'll have an answer for you soon.
Okay, and on the same slide there, towards the bottom, related to strategy number two, Port Commission updates to Ventura City Council. Last year, we had then Chair Stevens and at that time Vice Chair Blumenberg and myself provide City Council updates. I know Jessica is going to be reaching out to the city clerk to coordinate a meeting we were looking at for spring. Obviously, this time we'll want to coordinate with your two schedules, chair and vice chair. And I thought we had a great opportunity, Chris, to kind of showcase the different projects and programs and things that the Port District was working on last year. So that'll be coming soon. And continuing on to the next slide, I'd probably touch on strategy four, annual review and updates to HR manual, board protocols manual, and so on. As it relates to that on achievements, the HR manual, again, looking back to December, under review, going through significant effort on the part of LCW, our legal counsel for human resources activities. Ultimately, in January, you provided those final approvals to the updates to the plan. But a lot of that work was done in the fall of last year. And then I mentioned earlier the public and civic engagement plan update, and that was approved in December. So a lot of these policies that were adopted coming from the first five-year objectives and then updated have actually now gone through a second iteration in some instances. Next. And next on commercial fishing and sustainable aquaculture industries, a couple of notes here under strategy one, engagement with sustainable aquaculture industry interests at Ventura Harbor. We've had a couple of two businesses come to visit us here, tour district commercial fishing facilities in October with one macroalgae firm, commonly known as kelp, and meeting in November with the mussel farming firm and consultants with some potential interest in the Santa Barbara Channel area. Both companies have continually been referred to all the information on our website that was gathered resulting from the sea grants that were successfully concluded here at the Port District. So there's a wealth of knowledge in that database online for them to use. Down on strategy two, identifying and pursuing grant funding opportunities to implement capital infrastructure needs for commercial fishing and sustainable aquaculture. Staff, as you know, worked with Port of Hueneme and their consultants to apply for grant funding to modernize commercial fishing infrastructure at the harbor in order to accept squid offloading. So some of those actions you've taken since then, but some of those efforts started in the last quarter.
Ryan, could you refresh our memory? When is that Port of Hueneme grant application going to be decided upon?
So I think submitted here just in the last couple of weeks. And Todd, is it the spring? I'm not sure if we have anything more specific than that, but maybe Todd knows.
The official date is supposed to be the end of March, but we know how short a time frame that really is for an agency like that big to make that many decisions with $1.3 billion. So I don't realistically expect March, but we'll see.
And there's continued to be efforts with the consultant and meeting with our commercial fishing interests just in the last couple of weeks. So that some of those efforts are underway as it relates to the monies that the board allocated for our efforts in this. And then also this past fall, some of our efforts just to reach out to the industry as a whole continued. I participated as a panelist in November for a one-day conference, Blue Economy, the Role of Ports in Developing Sustainable Marine Fisheries. That was put on by Cale Gates based out of Seattle, but they broadcast that via a webinar opportunity. And on to our next one, which is master tenants. Been very busy in this category. A lot of different things underway. Under strategy one, working with master tenants to help facilitate sustainable capital improvement projects. District acted as the lead agency in review of the proposed development plans for both Director Marine Holdings here tonight and for the Ventura Yacht Club. You recently took action on the Ventura Yacht Club application, and the Director Marine Holdings project will be coming forth soon. Coordination with Portside on commercial tenant leasing. I have bi-weekly meetings with the Portside managing partner. But separately from that, both myself and Todd met with the master tenant to discuss leasing status, efforts, and opportunities for collaboration. One of the things that came from that discussion resulted in an opportunity in the mid-year budget to include signage, new signage at Schooner and Harbor on the parking lot area that we own. That contract is now signed for architectural design, and in the coming few weeks, we'll be back on the agenda. We're looking at signage that will be supportive of the different business activities on the side of the harbor, not just port side, but there was certainly interest coming from the new businesses within port side itself to pursue that. Evaluate master planning opportunities in conjunction with current and future leasehold development. Touched on the Yacht Club. Also, Ventura Marina West has begun discussions about their leasehold and opportunities for development potential moving forward. So we'll hear more about that probably in the coming months. And then under Ventura Water Pure, this is, of course, the city's project and initiative. Certainly that has become more relevant to the Port District with the realignment of the project from harbor through the harbor and through a couple of our master tenant parcels along with district land. And that's been an ongoing effort. You've heard two presentations from city staff on that. And that continues to move forward. They are still, as I understand it, planning for a fall 2023 project. And we'll see if that continues to move forward at that pace. But certainly from a project and time commitment perspective, it has certainly added a lot of time commitment to our staff in trying to work with the city staff to implement their project. Next.
Brian, before you leave that, I mean, I know it's not on our agenda, so we can't talk about any detail. When do you foresee us having another report to us in an open session? I'm very curious. October 19th, that seems a long time ago that we've had an update. So,
yeah, I think I think at the board's pleasure, if we ask the city to come back and give a status report publicly here, I'm sure they would accommodate that. So if you'd like.
I'd certainly like to see something in the next month or so.
Okay, on to Maintain and Grow Channel Islands National Park. The National Park Service presence and customer visitation. One of the things that we've had is several meetings with the National Park Service and with the Marina West team, Marina West 2, regarding parking and signage and access to the visitor center at the end of Spinnaker Drive. So the parking that is provided for the park service is, of course, their street parking. But there are agreements in place that relate to Ventura West 2 to accommodate parking for the visitor center and also at Harbor Cove, a beach parking lot that we own and operate. Some of the signage there, I think all the parties agree, could be improved. From a tenant perspective, they're always trying to work to make sure the right people are using their parking lot, visitor center folks, people coming to the Harbor Cove Cafe, their own tenants, and so on. And because of its proximity to the beach, obviously a lot of people want to try to use that as parking. So we're working with them on new signage plans and also maybe some rearranging of some of the facilities within that lot, including a trash enclosure that is outdated and in prime location that maybe could be relocated to a different spot. So we've had actually multiple meetings, but two in particular were in this last quarter. And is the biostation completely built out at this point? No. Okay. But we have an agreement in place with the National Park Service to construct, I think by way of a license agreement, a small biosecurity station right next to Island Packers on our property. Again, that's for folks going out to the island. It's a little wash station for your feet and shoes so that you're not accidentally transmitting maybe seeds and other things that take non-native species out to the island. So kind of a great little partnership between the three of us, really. And then on to parking. Obviously, as you are well aware, a lot of activity on parking, both in terms of grants under Strategy 1, seeking a sustainable transportation grant. I think that's going to City Council, Todd, in the next few weeks.
27th, I think it is.
The 27th. So the city has been in support of working with the Port District to secure funds that they can secure that we can't for sustainable transportation grant planning here in the harbor. Todd and I also met with the city's transportation engineer in their five-year CIP capital improvement plan is the repaving of Navigator from Spinnaker Drive to Anchors Way Drive. And so that would be in front of Holiday and Express, four points by Sheridan, coming across in front of Ventura West. And ending about right there. Yeah. There is a section that wouldn't include. We have expressed our desire to the city to finish the rest of the street, which takes you along Portside. And the budget that they have is for the portion that I just described. So just as recently as this last week, we've been in communication with the city manager and the public works director regarding that. So, but this will be a redo of the street, and I believe it'll also improve striping for bicycles. And I think also a new crosswalk between at ground level. There's a bridge that connects the Four Points and the Holiday Inn Express. I think at ground level, they're going to put a new crosswalk in as well. And again, improved bike lanes. It would be great if we could get the entire street from start to finish completely done. Let's see, we've also had on parking, a quick little pilot project that we had during Parade of Lights, and I give credit to Todd here. He certainly collaborated with John and Jennifer and so on, but kind of a quick, like 2 weeks before the Parade of Lights, working with the airport or shuttle, we paid for them to provide service to and from the Parade of Lights from the parking lot at Schooner and Harbor, so 19A. And then we had a second stop over at Portside to pick up. And then the drop-off point was in what's called the Dolphin Lot, which is at the Safe Harbor Ventura Isle Marina, and then looping around. And I think we got some decent ridership off of that, again, promoted by Jennifer on social media and so on for folks to at least give that a try. I think in terms of working with the operator, I think all went well. So that was great. And Jessica, on to revenues. So here you certainly have heard a lot about working on EV charging stations in the Harbor Village and charger procurement complete on the achievement designs for Port District headquarters submitted to the city, and Southern Cal Edison working on final designs for the village. Complete installation of 4 EV charging stations at district offices for company vehicles. Designs have been submitted to the city for that for permitting. And down at the bottom under strategy 3, leasing and property management, through active marketing, continue to attract a diverse array of businesses and business owners to Ventura Harbor with the goal of expanding the offerings to the public while creating value for the district. And again, I mentioned DEI and the efforts of Jennifer and her team. But on the leasing side, we've expanded some of our outreach in terms of advertisements for leasing opportunities at the village as well. So that happened. And then also on revenues, strategy 4, rollout of new accounting and property management software. Yeah, I'm sorry, next slide. Rolling out of new accounting and property management software, MRI, which is the company was selected, software rollout complete for Harbor Village. And then down below on financial reporting, accounting division has begun working with CLA on the implementation of new lease accounting and audit preparation. And last, Village, Harbor Village facilities. And in terms of strategy, strategy 1, complete outstanding ADA improvements and capital improvement plan. You certainly have seen a significant number of projects that have been completed and are underway, but from the award of contracts that you've seen come through for the restrooms, trash enclosures, the 2 trash enclosures are much closer to completion now. There'll be the removal of the 3 older trash enclosures as part of this contract. And of course, that improves not only waste management, but ADA capabilities to those trash enclosures as well, which is required. We've also had the roof replacement projects that you've probably seen on several of the buildings, village tenant signage. In terms of our landscaping, we continue to replace plant materials with drought-resistant plants and changing out sprinkler irrigation to drip irrigation systems. Lastly, seasonal decor. I think we had a very successful holiday season in terms of decor. Again, the board's been extremely supportive of increasing that budget over the last 3 to 4 years and really making, you know, a substantial difference in the overall look, feel, and appearance of the village during the holiday. So that went through a RFP process this year this last year. And a successful bidder was hired on to do the work, and we thought did a great job. So I think that covers a little bit of each of these, and turn it back to the board for questions and comments.
Thank you, Brian. Let's look for any public comments first. Tom, did you want to address the dredging issue now?
An expert on the Brown Act now.
That's right.
Very fancy setup here like this. Hello. On the dredging, this year in particular, January, with the storms and the surge, the way the shipyard is configured, we get a lot of silt buildup in our travel lift area, and it's been very difficult. We can only get boats out now at peak tide, so it's having a real hamper on our business. Wondering for some way of piggybacking this time formally and well in advance of the dredging that's being done in the harbor. And if there's any way to get some, I don't know, relief funds to help pay for our little section of that, it would have a very positive impact to our business and allow us to handle larger boats and be able to handle it through a full tide cycle, which you know, we were up at 6:30 this morning to haul a 50-foot boat out, and it's getting pretty challenging. So thanks for your time.
Andy, would be appropriate maybe add on to that? I just wanted to ask the question because I was in a conversation with the city recently about how they're getting the city beaches cleaned. And they're doing that through some emergency permitting, but more importantly, filing with FEMA over in regards to the storm because an emergency was declared by the city. And I'm wondering, certainly what I saw in that video of the amount of sand and sediment that was just pushing down the channel, I can understand what you're talking about, Tom. It's a wonder you don't have breaking waves literally in there. So I'm wondering, do we have get an oar in the water in regards to anything like this to maybe, if it was additional, I know we have programmed dredging funds, but over and above something like that?
I think it's possible, but I think what we ought to do is defer that to the next agenda item while we talk about the emergency proclamation, because that's more to my thinking, obtaining that funding is more part of that process than than the five-year plan.
Great. Thank you.
Good point. Any other public comments here, Lenore? Bill?
Just really quick, I sent this over to Brian just a second ago. The city's doing the CIP budget at our next meeting on the 227. So if there's anything you'd like me to advocate for, get in there, you know, please reach out so I can get that on. And we'll be adopting the CIP at the March 27th meeting. We're presenting the review of the CIP on the 27th, and we're adopting it on the March 27th. So
Councilman, I would note that the board did request previously that I send a letter to the city regarding the street conditions broadly in the harbor, so not specific to one street. So we did do that, and I would like to forward that correspondence to you. There's also been some very specific correspondence, as I said, related to Navigator, because that is a project that's already CIP funded and slated for construction this year. So city staff came out and met with us to go walk it.
Jessica, do we have any other public comments online? No? Commissioners?
Forgot me so quickly. Hi.
I thought you were calling out.
I was raising my hand for him.
Yeah, that's what I like.
So in terms of the objectives for the harbor, I just wanted to say that one of the things that we sort of promised when we were pitching to the Port District to allow us to come here was that we were really going to look hard at sustainability and electric. And I'm very happy to say that we have the first electric boat company that has appointed Director Ventura as their service center. They're out of Europe. The boat, actually, one of their sample boats is at our yard right now. And we have a temporary setup of a fast charger for marine, which is the only marine grade fast charger, also headquartered in Europe, but the chargers are made in the US. So if anybody would like to see it or check out the boat or go for a ride, you know, let us know. But this is the first step in our plan to be a center of excellence for electric boats. And we have spoken briefly with companies like Navier, which is a foiling electric boat company up in Alameda, who's also very interested in knowing that there's a service yard, because this is going to be a real challenge for these companies. The Miami Boat Show that I'm going to this weekend has, I think, 10 electric boat companies there this year. So it's really pushing out, and it's going to be a big thing in supporting the objective of the harbor to look at sustainability.
Yeah, that's exciting news. What size boat is that? 24 footer. Oh, okay. 24 foot rib. Yeah. Yeah. Great start. Yeah. That was one of the things that we had.
I didn't understand any of that.
Rigid hull inflatable boat.
That's right.
So. All right. Other comments?
I just want to say, since I've been on the board, the CIP efforts and Jose, your team and everything that's been done to improve the harbor over the last 5 years, it's really been amazing to see the strategy and the efforts that has gone into it. So thank you for not just what you've done, but I know the efforts that are coming forward as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just add, thank you for that summary, by the way, but you know, I think it's real important in my mind anyway, is that what the staff has taken on, I'll say some of the more mundane things that are not viewed by the public, our personnel procedures, our accounting and property management software. We've really made a lot of strides in those kind of activities. And then doing kind of some interesting, your pilot program on the shuttle, for example. It's relatively modest, but that's kind of a neat kind of forward-thinking project that you're doing. And there's just a lot of stuff in here that you're doing. And it's, I think, great that we've got it in a place for everyone to see and have an opportunity to understand it. But great work.
Thank you.
Ditto. I'm glad you put the letters on there, because V is a lot of, that's a lot of things with all the strategies and everything like that. Needless to say, the port is a very agile organization. I mean, if you look at everything that it's doing, from technology to what aren't we doing? I think it's a more complex organization than I think people give it credit for or realize. And I hope that the staff and our customers and our clients and our tenants appreciate that the efforts that staff does, because I'm looking at it and I'm going, whoa, you know, this is a lot of stuff to be doing. So I just want to just say that very, very agile. Most governments are not this complex and doing everything with the size of our staff and the fact that where we get our revenue and we're always looking for getting more money, I just think is a commendable thing.
Thank you. And I know the staff that's here and staff that are listening really appreciate that feedback very much so.
So I'll close this item by just agreeing. I like this format, because as everybody said, you've accomplished a lot in this past quarter, but you also have a lot of goals left ahead of us. And this is kind of a good forum to just remind us of all the great ideas that are out there, all the things we want to do, and just helps us keep track of all that and then report back on what we do get done. So great work. Appreciate that update. We'll close out this item and we'll move on to our next item on the agenda, which is the state of emergency.
And Jessica, no action needed, just receive the report.
It's up to you.
Okay.
We could do a motion or we don't have to. It does say receive and file.
I move we receive and file the report.
Got a motion and a second to receive and file. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, we'll receive and file. Thank you. Thanks for the reminder.
It just felt good. All right. Thank you. Jessica, why don't you jump to, you know what? Maybe I earlier I was telling you to jump straight to that last item, but maybe a few photos at the front end here aren't bad. I mean, this is certainly what Sergio and Wayne and others were dealing with on shore. John and his team were dealing with similar conditions on the water. Your approving of the emergency declaration allowed us to move forward with contracts and agreements to do debris removal. I think we had mentioned we went after the larger debris, left the smaller debris, and then wanted to have a discussion with the Army Corps of Engineers and the Manson as relates to the beach areas, because that's where the nourishment takes place when the dredge materials are moved to the Ventura beaches here at the harbor. Generally speaking, the smaller debris at Harbor Cove Beach was not needed by the Corps or by Manson. So we did expand that contract to make the beach as safe as we could for the public. I think what we saw out there was bamboo, sharp edges, things like that, that was of the smaller material. Some of that still is buried and continues to wash up. But I think, Sergio, we've expended, I think what was about $20,000 in direct debris removal activity for the benefit of our beachgoers. I think as we talked about as well, we had quite a few beachgoers that were jumping in themselves and helping with some of that removal, as well. But, the group was able to bring in some staffing, contractor staffing and some heavy equipment to get some of those things out. So in the last 2 weeks, here's sort of our list of things that have occurred since then. So larger debris removal in waters in and around the harbor and Ventura Keys. Ongoing, certainly reduced. I think John's team continues to look for that, and when they encounter, they'll tow branches, debris, et cetera, over to the launch ramp where Sergio has placed a roll-off dumpster to receive those. But I would guess, John, it's a lot less today than it might have been a couple of weeks ago, for sure. Heavy debris I just touched on being removed from the harbor and beaches, with the district having entered agreements, as I mentioned, first prioritizing the larger debris and getting a green light to remove some of the smaller debris at Harbor Cove Beach. Refuse containers, as we mentioned last time, have been rented and placed at both beach parking lots at Harbor Cove Beach and at Surfers Knoll, both for the public and ourselves to be able to remove debris. We talked several times tonight about dredging. As discussed, we had a meeting with the Corps and with Manson in the last week and a half or so, and a meeting Todd and I attended virtually today. Again, the intent is late February, early March, dredging activity will be underway. But again, the level of beach erosion is significant and exceeds normal pre-dredge conditions. So on the one hand, you're hoping there's not a lot of sand in the navigation channel or in the sand trap, but in our case, the navigational channel, other than when there was high surf and those issues that John worked with the Coast Guard on during the storm events, more of the sand is where it should be, which is in the sand trap. And so it's sort of, in this case, good news that there's more sand there that can be moved to help replenish the erosion on our beaches here at the harbor. Now, given how much erosion has taken place, we don't think it's going to solve for that completely. Some of the cliffing that you saw was just too extreme to handle that. But having gone from a couple hundred thousand cubic yards to over a half a million cubic yards, with maybe a half a million being available for beach nourishment and erosion repair and mitigation, we're hopefully in a better position. So the Corps is looking at, they're looking at their budget, they're looking at their costs. One thing they do caution about today is if they have encountered a lot of debris at Channel Islands Harbor during the dredge, and that has slowed the dredge down, and they're delayed there, and they also have another harbor to get to when they're done with this harbor. So their one concern is how much debris might be in the sand trap that could slow them down. Weather always plays a factor, but those are kind of the considerations that they have to think about, as opposed to just saying, well, there's over 500,000 cubic yards, we're going to move it all. And there's a lot of different things they're working on. But again, we have impressed upon them our desire for them to move as much as they possibly can before they move on to their next harbor. Warning signage, John, are those installed? So John ordered new warning signage at the beach areas, talked about the Army Corps, the soundings that were performed, which led to the, let's call it good news. Building and public launch repairs have been ongoing. Sergio, still some of that still ongoing, or are we about wrapped up? Okay, still ongoing there. And this is a photo, Todd and I, John's previously attended this when there's been other disasters. This is at the County Emergency Operations Center. Commissioner Stevens and possibly Brendan may know this spot well. This is down in the, let's call it the basement or the bunker, whatever, however you want to look at it, of County Sheriff's Office building. And we attended a training session last week on FEMA recovery application opportunities to submit. These are pretty complex submissions and a lot of paperwork and a lot of follow through. They're fairly staff intensive, with obviously the hope that you get some dollars back for some of the costs. So the typical kinds of things that we would seek reimbursement for are the kinds of things you just heard about, repairs to Port District assets, the hiring of contractors to do debris removal, time spent in disaster response. That does not have to be overtime. It has to be time and hours dedicated to responding. So that can be Harbor Patrol, who obviously immediately assisted the city in the City Keys area, working to, in some cases, docks that had been severed from land with boats attached to them, and trying to safely get them out of the Keys and into areas that would be safer away, working with some of our private marina operators to give safe passage into some temporary locations there, taking, I think in almost all instances, the damaged or destroyed private docks were allowed to transit to our public launch ramp for destruction and removal and so on. So there are a lot of hours involved in the disaster response. We are tracking those and would include those in our application. So it's not just somebody spent an extra 4 hours on top of a 12-hour shift. It's that the 12 hours was dedicated to disaster response. And that's not just in the case of Harbor Patrol, but folks in facilities and others. There is an admin component. I think it's up to 5%. You have to demonstrate the hours spent on that activity as well. So right now, in terms of application, that's sort of where we're focused on that, because there are dollars available via the Corps budget for dredging of the harbor entrance channel. We're working, as we've talked about, with the Army Corps to move as much material as they can. As it relates to inner harbor dredging, that gets more complicated in terms of what could be eligible here or not. And what could we apply for or not? We can't just dredge without a dredge. Dredge is only here for 3 or 4 weeks out of the year. To hire a dredge separately from that would be very costly to either a master tenant or to the harbor. Whether or not it can be determined that certain amounts of material in the inner harbor are directly related to the disaster events. I think in two areas we know that to be true. One is the Arendelle Barranca. I think the soundings, and maybe John can speak to this. I think what's been shown so far is that there's more buildup in the city portions than possibly the Port District's portion, meaning the entrance into the City Keys area. The second area is a storm drain runoff near the Holiday Inn Express that comes off of Agland on the other side of Harbor and Olivas Park Drive. There is some shoaling, if I'm using that in the right context here, John, near Safe Harbor's Marina Ventura Isle. So those are kind of two areas that have been identified. One is a county flood control storm drain. The other is, I believe, a city-owned drain coming off of the ag areas. I do know in communication with city manager, there was, I think, an expanded declaration or a renewed declaration made regarding the city, and I believe they included the harbor in that declaration, or at least that was the intent. So we still have questions in our own mind as to, you know, what could potentially FEMA do here or not, and how to apply if we were going to for something outside of the Army Corps' jurisdiction, which is the entrance channel itself. So I don't know, John, you want to comment, and Todd, feel free.
Just real quick, as in regards to the inner harbor effects relating to the storm, we have to prove that there was an increase in infill. And in the Arundel Barranca, we have that data from last year when we did the soundings, and we have several years old data in that other area back by VIM and the Holiday Inn Express. That silt came from the farmland, and so that was how there was a buildup there. It's really concentrated towards the reventment, but unfortunately that's where they decided to put their pump out. So it does obstruct boats' ability to go in and use that pump out. But I think it's going to be very difficult to, without absolute data, to say that there has been additional infill in other areas of the harbor, because we haven't had that type of baseline created. We asked the city, for example, potholes, you know, can you just repave all the streets in the harbor, because the potholes are crazy. They said, well, we would have to show that the streets were pristine before the event, and the potholes afterwards were entirely a result of that singular event. It could be quite difficult, but certainly we'll look into it. And then the county has established that residents and businesses can apply for aid in through FEMA, and they have their facility at the fairgrounds. So that is an option, and there may be other opportunities to clear that area out separate to Manson and their process. It's going to be on a really tight timeline, and the inner harbor is not part of that timeline. The timeline's the harbor entrance and the sand trap.
John's right. I'll just say there's also the additional complexity of what this particular dredge can do in terms of the fact that it's 240 feet long, and where it can go and what it can do for in terms of dredging in the inner harbor. For example, it could not do the harbor, the Holiday Inn Express area. It simply couldn't go there. The Barranca, it can do a good portion. It can't do it all. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly where the director is referring to in terms of the travel lift, but I mean, you know, the cutter head on the head of the dredge is almost as big as this room. So the ability to be nimble about positioning, and then the next part is permits. That's not a small endeavor. the Corps does not have permits to do the Inner Harbor, only we do. So it's that's a much bigger conversation than can be answered here.
Michael, Sheriff, I might. Todd, following up on that, I mean, watching that video, and certainly what Thomas said, I could. Is it going to be a problem for us for navigation in that channel? I mean, even just because we haven't really, we haven't taken Bethimage 3 there in probably a while, so we can't maybe charge it off. But I'm concerned, that low tide, some of the area off the national park, some of that, there's going to be a good sized berm in there. You know more than I, but just seeing going in and out of there. Myself, I'm just thinking about as time goes on, the boats with a pretty good keel on low tide are going to maybe be in some problems.
Yeah. So our staff did do soundings beyond the federal channel. The federal channel is basically the statues west. Yeah. And so we've came inside, and then anecdotally, as we drive around the harbor, we've seen no adverse shoaling. Like, for example, you would say that it's very logical for there to be shoaling in this basin here because of the outflow from the Barranca. Yeah. However, we haven't seen anything negative. We haven't seen any significant sand movement within, and it wouldn't normally be within. The sand was really traveling down coast, and that's why there's in the sand trap. We didn't see significant increases in the entrance. We saw sand in the entrance, and that was a result of the scouring in there. So there could be some sediment that came in, but I don't think to significant levels where we could say definitively, yes, this was a result of. But certainly Todd and myself and we can work with the directors on what their options are. Like I said, outside of Manson, because it doesn't appear that this year that's going to be an option. But perhaps as we get more information, as we establish the baseline and what's resulted from these storms, and if we have the opportunity to apply for funding to do Inner Harbor dredging, we certainly will do it. I mean, we're not going to skip on a chance to do something like that.
Okay. Well, I would just like to say that anything we can do to further their effort, what we just heard about the electric boats, electrification. I mean, I know it's a small 24-foot rigid inflatable, but, other boats are going to, the ability to bring those boats in will be a challenge. So I see this as an opportunity to work closer. And I know we do have a good relationship, and you got a lot of going on, but I think my worry is that we don't see the sand now, but then it starts finding its way in. But
yeah, I think maybe to early something John said, I would encourage Tom and Leonora to potentially look at filing their own private disaster. If they think there's a condition there that was caused by the storm events, then I would certainly encourage them to apply to FEMA.
I know that you're headed off to the boat show, because I got an invitation to go down to Miami myself, but I can't. But the FEMA, they've closed them in Santa Barbara, and they've closed them in San Luis Obispo, but they're keeping the one at the fairgrounds open, and it's from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. At the fairgrounds. Maybe before you go off, maybe just find out. I don't know how much longer they're going to be there, but I think this is at least find out if it's the opportunity maybe to file a claim or something, because I do think that some of these things we find out later when FEMA goes, all of a sudden, oh, I should have done that. So
I will just reiterate, I think several of you have experience with this. It is extremely complex to not understated.
And us encouraging them to file theirs is not us deferring the responsibility. It's that would help bolster our claim that we have an issue, and potentially those will, equally benefit more.
Regarding baseline, I'll just say that we do have a harbor-wide baseline survey from 2021.
You have it too. You have it too.
That was actually my question. I'm imagining that these weather events are going to become the norm. Emergency declarations and available funding is going to become part of our future on a regular basis. Is there a way for us to do more baseline surveys that would allow us to say, here's what it was before the event, here's what it was after the event? Some of the soundings that you do rather than kind of the entire survey every couple of years.
Yeah, John's team does have, we'll call, no disrespect, rudimentary versions of the equipment to do a, you know, the kind of survey that Manson does or the Corps does in terms of pay volume. You know, it's about $500,000 worth of equipment, or you can pay a company to do, you know, $25,000, $30,000 to go do that every time. We sometimes do that, which we did in 2021, to do a baseline or update the baseline. It's make sure that you're spending the money well when you make that decision, because the Corps will do the entrance and the area adjacent to this office for free. So these are the areas where the greatest sedimentation happens. So every year we're getting the highest risk area updated at no cost to us. They just do it the extra little bit for us as a freebie, because Manson will every few years get to do the dredging at a contract with us, separate from that with the Corps. So updating the entire thing, worthwhile on occasion, and this may be a good occasion, but you know, it's, you have to have the foresight to do it in advance, but it's certainly something we can contemplate doing more regularly.
So Todd, the 2021 baseline was done by a contractor like Fugro?
It's Fugro, yeah.
Okay. And buying our own bathy unit is probably cost prohibitive.
John would be very happy.
So I didn't ask John.
Making him happy. Realistically, between three-quarters and $500,000 to outfit the boat.
When you can contract, and the contract was much less than that.
$30,000.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm assuming, Todd, that was not the entire harbor. That was portions of navigational parts and the open areas that we manage.
Yeah, so not into the berths, for example, but it was all of the navigation channels. Effectively, everywhere the boat could readily access without going into individual berths. But there's a pretty detailed contour map that goes like to the shoreline, everywhere that you could get to the shoreline.
Other comments, questions from the commissioners? Brian, do we have any public comments here? Any public comments? Public comments online? So let me go back to the agenda item. So we originally approved the resolution in a previous meeting. So what you're asking us to consider tonight is continuing that emergency resolution.
Correct. So the timing for the initial application is February 25th for public agencies. I don't know if the dates are exactly the same for private interests, but what we were told is the initial application needs to be filed by the 25th. So we are going to continue to move forward with that and file that. The 25th is a Saturday. We'll be filing it on as soon as the 24th or sooner. And that really starts the process. That's the initial application, and there's a series of steps after that.
And if the board agrees to, or votes to continue this emergency resolution, we would need to revisit it in another month? At our March 1st meeting, or at our next meeting, every meeting. We look at that. Okay. So...
Well, I think your reports demonstrated a need to do that. So I'd make a motion that we continue the emergency action as set forth in Resolution 3462.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to continue the emergency resolution 3462. This would be a roll call vote.
Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
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 Yes. All right, so we've worked our way through the agenda. I want to look ahead a little bit, if I may, to that March 1st meeting. So at that March 1st meeting, I'm going to loop back to the Brown Act discussion. So since I'll be on travel for district business, my intention would be to participate remotely. I think another thing that we didn't talk about in the Brown Act, but has come up in previous discussions, is the chairman should be local. And so if I'm participating from a video teleconference, I think the rule of thumb has been we want a local chair of the meeting. Is that true?
Just for purposes of running the meeting?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I thought you had a rule that the chair has to be local and you can never go anywhere.
No. Just that we want the meeting run with somebody.
Yes, it would make the meeting run more smoothly.
You're welcome.
One of my questions in the Brown Act is, could I actually move to have any of the members removed for being disruptive?
I think it's implicit.
I think it's time to adjourn. So I thank the staff for hanging with us tonight. Councilman McReynolds, thank you for joining us tonight. And anybody who...
And the directors for hanging in.
And the directors, of course, for hanging in there. And hopefully we can help you with your issues. Good luck at the Miami Boat Show with that electric boat. I'm very curious. So thanks for anybody who was hanging in there offline. And we are going to adjourn for tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you.